I refer to the, you know, Chinese chronological system, the year and you know, the element and the charge. It's a beautiful system. It's a moving and instructive system for me. I'm not a teacher of that system, so I'm not going to give that aspect of it. But I linked under the announcement for this talk in the Facebook group. I linked a talk by given by a teacher named William Kohlhase, who's in the East Bay, or of late was in the East Bay here. And he was one of the senior students of a wonderful teacher named Liu Ming. And Liu Ming was an American who connected very, very deeply with both the Chinese Taoist and Chan systems, but also with the Tibetan Vajrayana system, Nyingma system, and he was recognized as a Lama in the Tibetan system and given transmission in the Chinese system, and he was adopted into the Liu family in China. And in the years that I knew him, which were the last several years of his life, he, you know, he was a wild, strange, interesting human, and you know, the depth to which he merged in a certain way with the lineage that he studied was profound. You would look at him and wonder if he actually was Chinese. It's almost like all of his features took on the wisdom of this culture that he had so deeply been embraced by and embraced. And he taught this system of pole star astrology and helped found and teach at the School of Feng Shui in the East Bay, and you know, but also transmitted Tibetan Buddhist teachings. He was an extraordinary teacher, and so everything I know about this system comes from being in his proximity, and I had the great privilege to be. Nicholas said a little bit about visiting an acupuncturist in relation to process, health process, energetic process, and I had the great privilege to work with a quite senior herbalist and acupuncturist in Oakland named Dr. Louis, who really transformed my bodily energetic system and that of my partner as well. Deep healing there. So I have a lot of reverence and just gratitude for this system and tradition that came through Liu Ming. And so I linked William's talk on the year of the Yin Water Rabbit beneath this week's satsang. Ming would give a talk every year on the auspices of the year, and you know, to a crowd of hundreds of people, they would rent a huge room in somewhere in the Bay Area, like a big theater. He would give this enormous talk, and then send the benefits back to these monasteries and nunneries that he was supporting in Tibet and Nepal. So, veneration to Liu Ming on that lineage. So you can hear William's talk on the year there, and it's totally fascinating. So we're entering the year of the Yin Water Rabbit, coming out of the Yang Water Tiger, and this instruction of in and down is the kind of pith instruction that William brought forth in the auspices for this coming year. So I'm just going to reflect on that and the quality of yin a bit here. And What a blessing here locally in California that you know, that the end of the Water Tiger year saw, you know, the most extraordinary storms that we've seen in many years, and filled the reservoirs in a way that has not happened in many, many years. So, you know, gratitude for the great, you know, dragons of rain that came from Southeast Asia to drench, and in some cases, somewhat excessively wash away our towns and rivers. Compassion to those who lost their lives and family members in those storms, and gratitude for water. So the instruction in and down the, you know, some of the kind of core directions and orientations of yin are so central in our practice, you know, in the practice of meditation, but also in even the way that we hear the instructions on mindfulness in the Buddhist texts. You might remember, if you've spent time with the core text on the instructions for mindfulness, the Satipatthana Sutta, the foundations or establishment of mindfulness, the instruction in the refrain that is repeated after every one of the exercises. So the discourse of the Satipatthana, the foundations of mindfulness, goes through a sequence of orientations, beginning with the body, the posture of the body, movements, activities, and then into abstractions of body as a way to understand, you know, that the body is composed of parts, and then a reflection on the great elements, that the body is composed of, manifesting the qualities of the elements, and then that the body has the nature of mortality, and reflecting on the inevitable decay and dissolution of the body. And then reflection on feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feeling, how this is the basis of emotion, the basis of reactivity, right? So mindful of feelings as they come and go. And then mindful of deeper or more pervasive emotional states, states of you know, unwholesome tone, the great poisons, grasping, greed, hatred, delusion, and their presence, their absence. Being mindful when the mind is concentrated, when it's not, when it's fixated, when it's not. And then mindful of a whole set of really reflections on the deeper psycho-emotional qualities of the Dhamma. So awareness of the presence or absence of the hindrances, the awakening factors, the behavior, the unfolding of the aggregates, of the sense bases, of the Four Noble Truths themselves. So mindful of the presence of suffering, the absence of suffering. And so, in this whole sequence of really a kind of targeted reflections that point us to engagement with what really shapes our life, the experiences, physical, emotional, cognitive, that shape our experience, there's a refrain, so a kind of repeated passage in between every one of the exercises, that says that we should become mindful of whatever the things we're focusing on, internally, externally, and both internally and externally. And sometimes we talk about this instruction, internal and external, in a kind of social or relational frame. So I'm mindful of my own body, like the position of my body. Let's say I'm tuning into proprioception. I know that I'm sitting, I know where my arms are, that kind of thing. And then I'm aware of the posture of the bodies of others. And this is, you can think of this as a kind of, you know, the mindfulness part of empathy. I partly know how you might feel by seeing how you're sitting or standing or moving, right? So there's a kind of being attuned to other here. So that's one interpretation. Some teachers like that interpretation, some don't. It's ambiguous in the original text as to exactly what internal and external is pointing to. So that's partly why teachers argue about these things. I think it's helpful enough to think about it as relational. I teach on that sometimes. Some of us are, you know, a little relationally handicapped, and it can be useful to practice being mindful of others. So be mindful of others. And there's a compelling argument that suggests that the intent of the original instruction is not actually relational particularly, but that it's actually about more of a directionality that attention or awareness itself can have. And so you can point your senses outward. I can see and hear and smell and think about, let's say, the room that I'm in. I could think about the images, the furniture, the colors, the emotional resonance of the space, what it means. So the cognitive aspect of here, how I feel when I'm here, all of that in a way is the senses engaged in the external. And if there were another person here, of course, they would be included in that. You're included in that in a way. You're external to my body, my senses. So I'm attending externally. Or there's a turn of attention or conscious awareness that I can make that turns inward. And the inward turn, sometimes it could include, closing the eyes, but you can do it without closing the eyes, right? You can just ignore what you're seeing and turn the attention inward. And there's a kind of interior sense that can then open up, right? So in some of the somatic nervous system work, the term neuroception, it's coined by Stephen Porges, is used to name the awareness of the interior of one's body. So the sense of, like, when you tune into your organs, when you tune into, if you do a meditation and you tune into the space of the heart and then the solar plexus and then, the deep organs and the viscera and then the center of the pelvis. Let's say you're like walking down through the chakras, for instance, as a one way to map the interiority. You might be engaged in a kind of neuroception, right? Or if you drop just into the belly, you feel the inside of the body. It's not just sensation, right? There's a sense when we turn into the body that you get things that have aspects of sensation, but there's also things that we call energy. They come partly as sensation, so you can sense movement, vibration, tingling, pressure, density. Sometimes they come as a mingled kind of somatic and other channels as well. Sometimes if I might say, when you bring your attention inward, what do you notice? And you might say, oh, I feel, like there's a solid mass or a heaviness at my solar plexus. This is one that I often feel. And, I'm not feeling an aspect of my skeleton. I'm not feeling the musculature of the diaphragm particularly. It's something else. And you know that it's something else because if you really feel into it, you say, well, what is that? And, it's just as likely that you might say, oh, it's like, it feels kind of tight and buzzy. You could use sensation words. Or you might say, one client said this to me once, one student said, well, it's like a 6 foot wide pit of infinite despair. And I just don't go too close. And I'm like, yeah, let's stay a few feet back from that one, but you bow to it, it's in there. And then I was like, what's it look like? And he's like, it's just dark. And it goes on forever. I'm like, yeah, cool. So, so there it's coming as image. There's an emotional tone. There's a kind of narrative embedded in the somatic feeling. And when we're doing somatic work, which is, a kind of trying to resolve a sort of hindrance in a different way in the body, you can go in through these different channels, right? Attention is inward. In the inward direction, you still have, for instance, image. So the visual sense operates externally, like I can see the room. But if I go inward, I can have an inner visual sense, of course, right? And there's practices you can do that really open up the inner visual sense, right? The visionary kinds of practices. But describing experience in terms of image or using the visual imagination is a kind of inwardness in the using the visual sense. So this is true for all of the senses. You know, I can hear the sounds that are here right now, or I can turn my attention inward and be haunted by a song that my kid won't let me stop playing on infinite repeat, or something else, or a conversation that I had with someone that won't stop playing on repeat. And there's a kind of inner hearing. And as I said in the meditation, there's a beautiful kind of meditation that can happen when that kind of cognitive seeing and hearing, images and sounds and narrative and stuff internally, when there's enough concentration and stillness that settles down, often there can be an internal hearing that some of the monastics in the forest sangha call the sound of silence. This was a practice that the British monastic teacher Ajahn Sumedho really emphasized, where you get really quiet and there's a kind of subtle ringing often. For me, it was like a little bit like the buzzing of bees or like a really distant bell that was just reverberating on and on. There's a whole passage on this at the end of the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, the 15th century text on the core practices of Hatha Yoga by Swatmarama, that says, in the first stage, it's like the tinkling of bells. In the second stage, it gets on to it being like trumpets and kettle drums. Like it can get loud in there. But mostly it's a kind of soft ringing that can be heard, and you can actually use it as a meditation object. And so meaning you can stabilize attention on it, develop some concentration, listen to it fairly steadily. And so we get this instruction in the mindfulness text, in the Satipatthana, that we can do any of these instructions, externally or internally. So, another example, in the second foundation, Vedana, feeling tone, we are instructed to become aware of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feeling, right? So with my attention external, I look over there, there's a beautiful painting of Krishna playing his flute under a full moon with the cows. And I feel so much pleasure when I look at it. Blessings to Krishna. Over there is the ceremonial fan that I was given when I was ordained in Burma. So there's a Burmese ceremonial monastic fan over there, also pleasurable. And unpleasant. What's unpleasant here? It's a very pleasant room. There's these screws sticking out of the wall on top of the windows where the old curtain rods were, and the screws, they're not easy to get out. They're kind of ugly. Yeah, minor, very minor, unpleasant. So attention can attune to the external, and pleasant, unpleasant is present. Attention can, turn to the internal, of course, and, there's pleasant feeling. I love talking about this with you. My body's pretty comfortable. There's also some unpleasant sensation, kind of internal, almost hard to describe, very subtle, somewhere in there. And when I turn the attention internal, I noticed that I didn't love the example of the screws on the wall and that it felt a little awkward. So that's slightly unpleasant. And on, right? So the instruction to become mindful internally, externally. And then this beautiful instruction, both. So in the refrain, become mindful of this aspect of experience, internal, external, and both. So pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feeling, internal, external, and both. The both I like a lot because it can sometimes seem, and a couple of you in our group reflection kind of brought in aspects of this where, the external world can really have its tone. It can be really young out there or really fast moving or whatever it is, and it's not always the case that your internal is yin, right? Like inside, you might be really fiery and mobile and having that kind of energy, and you're in an external situation that's pretty calm. I've been deep on meditation retreat at times and been like, wow, I am super fired up and I am not well attuned to the room that I'm in. There's all these like super quiet white people around in their shawls. I'm just like, I kind of want to punch something here. So your internal can be at odds with your external in lots of different ways. But the instruction, is to be mindful of both. I'm just aware, I'm just aware. It's cool. When you do both, I think this is, I like to interpret this myself as an encouragement to not polarize. So to not either kind of retreat to my internal as a way to hide out from the unpleasant external. I do a lot of that, meditation teacher, right? I found a good place to hide out. Or retreating into fantasy to, or to avoid the inner life because it's painful through excessive external activity, to run around and just keep being mobile in order to not feel internally. And the instruction both is that like, oh, it's not just that attention can go out and can come in, but actually that there's a lovely way of being that basically is deeply embodied and connected internally without cutting off or turning away from the external. So there's a kind of like, I know where I am and I can feel my inner being, and I'm still here engaged. So the instruction in and down, kind of thinking back into this yin aspect, in and down as a somatic instruction conforms with the meditative, inquiry-oriented, concentration-oriented, restful, peaceful, receptive, aspect of a lot of the meditation instructions, right? You find this instruction as well, of course, in the yogic traditions, right? In the limb of Patanjali's path for a withdrawal of the senses, right? This is the same practice. It's the kind of letting go of the external sensory engagement, turning inward. And as a couple of you reflected, this can be in some ways at odds with the general tone of the very busy world that we live in, that many of us live in. And the encouragement throughout the tradition to go in, to go inward, that there's a kind of there's a discipline in doing so that has a very that has some very particular challenges to it, it's a kind of letting go, of course. And I have a friend who says like that, I love this person so much. We're close. We've partied together a lot and had deep conversations and hung out and very, very sweet friendship. And he's like, at one point I was like, I think it kind of looks like the main way you suffer in life is FOMO. And like you're kind of happy-go-lucky, you just like things, it's a total greed type, right? So it likes things, is fun and enjoys things, and the only time I ever really see him complain is when he just can't make it to the party. And I'm totally not, that's not my suffering, I'm totally like, oh dear, I can't make it to the party. And I am kind of just like, whew. It's like I dodged a bullet and I get to, I send my sweetheart out. I'm like, you go to the party and have a great time. Do anything you want. I'm going to stay home. I'm going to meditate. I'm going to listen to a talk by some monk. It's going to be so boring. I'm going to go to sleep by 9 o'clock. This is going to be great, you know. But my friend, it's total FOMO, you know, and there and so, you know, the so that's a kind of fun example. But of course, with lots of kinds of work and engagement, you know, one of the places that I struggle with it is that it's hard for me to let go of the political cycle. So, you know, if I don't listen to the news for a few days, I start to have this nagging feeling that something might have happened that I should know about. And it becomes hard to turn inward, right? It's one of the challenges for inwardness is that you actually have to let go of the external. In some parts of our communities, this can even be seen as a kind of, you know, almost as unwholesome. Like if you don't pay attention, it's like you don't care, you know. Oh, you have to stay engaged. And we can get this message that we have to stay engaged in the culture, engaged in the fight, engaged in the action, engaged in work, you know. Now that I work from home, there's no excuse to not be at work, so I could be at work all the time. That all of those threads in the culture encourage not in and down. And so then there's a discipline of letting go of the external that you know, in our ordinary life, this can parallel in a way the challenge of dropping into retreat. In the beginning of retreat, one of the things that can be hard to do is to stop kind of looking around and figuring out where I'm going to be and getting all my stuff set and exploring, you know, where I am and just being like, just let all of that go. There's nothing to look at actually here, and to just let the attention come in and drop in. Along with the pull to have the attention going out, of course, there's the nervous system quality of negativity bias and vigilance that makes it hard to go in. So when there's been wounding in a way where I'm trained to expect, you know, attack of some kind, whether literal or you know, emotional or very subtle, the nervous system can have this, you know, very appropriate in some conditions and then not useful in others, instinct to always be scanning the room, right? There's some folks who are really uncomfortable in a group space closing their eyes, right? Because the social space hasn't been safe or the physical space hasn't been safe enough to feel good or at ease closing the eyes. And so inward can be a challenging instruction if the social field hasn't been safe for you, you know, and you know, if the housing field hasn't been safe, if you know, if meditation retreats full of middle class white folks are not a safe place for you, it can be hard. It's hard to drop in, right? So there's social oppression layers to in and down that have to be dealt with, right? The enough felt sense of safety is needed to actually be able to relax vigilance, because in and down requires that we actually let go of tending the external for a little while. And so we have to not just let go of the party and let go of the emails, but also let go of the subtle felt sense that if I don't track what's happening around me, something's going to crumble or fall apart or come in as a kind of assault on the senses. How do we figure out this kind of the sweet spot for us that allows us to actually drop in and, you know, into the open space inside? I think there's a lot here about setting up proper conditions for practice. If we're thinking about this in a meditative way, and I notice some of those hindrances coming up that it's hard to drop inward, I might think about, you know, certainly the physical space and the social space that I'm in. I might also think about, you know, the mental space that I'm in. Maybe I make a conscious intention to, close the workday so that I'm not being pulled outward cognitively into all those things that I'm doing. It's like, okay, I kind of log out and I close all the apps and I clear everything out, and it's like it's not time for that. And ritually, I do some chanting in a way to ritually say, like, no, I'm in a different kind of space. I'm in a safer kind of space. Sometimes in and down is supported by the presence of very safe, good friends. There can be, in the way that for some people the social field can be challenging, for other folks solitude or isolation can stir things up. And contact with this one's a little strange, but for some folks, having someone else or someone's else around can be a support for ignoring those people and dropping more deeply inward. This can happen, like for some folks this can really happen in body work, like on the table. If you really trust your practitioner to just like let them do their thing, and now I'm being really taken care of in a way where I can really drop. Sometimes on meditation retreat or in a sangha like this, I remember feelings of, sitting in live with people and knowing folks who are like, oh, how folks will reflect, I can't really meditate like this when I'm alone, but I can do it when I'm in a room with people. What's up with that? I go deeper internally when I have, a dozen people around me doing it with me, or 100 or whatever, your sweet spot number is, whatever your ideal retreat is. I think some of that is that, having other people in the room, we're all sharing the vigilance task. So like everyone here, actually, if these people feel safe to me, then they're also helping keep the space safe. And so I can really just let go into whatever's true, whatever's here for me. There's a kind of group field. And of course, the support of discipline. It's like, well, I'm kind of burnt out on sitting, but there's 5 more minutes of the sitting, and everyone else seems to be just sitting. So I can do it. There's a kind of uplift there as well. So just an encouragement to reflect on the conditions that are most supportive for us to find that deep, in and down, that inwardness. And then, lastly, not just in meditation, but just, as an antidote to other qualities in our culture that that are not as favorable to this kind of yin way of being or feeling. Just an encouragement to that we can, that it's supported by really curating our activities, curating how we engage with, the online world. That there's a kind of staying in touch with our tenderness, our softness, our deep still water kind of nature. And really, there can be, for some of you, that will come very naturally. That'll be your natural home. And then getting out into big activity is a stretch. For some of you, being in big activity is your natural home, and quieting down, going inward is the stretch. And so just the encouragement, in this system of understanding that the expansive and the contractive are always in, a dynamic flow together, to really make friends with both and to practice this, external, internal, and both kind of awareness. I'm just cultivating this thing that is less obvious, less external, less commonly praised in this culture, but that is, like, it is so nourishing when you can really, really plug into that current, the deep yin current, and be nourished by it. So. a little bit there. Blessings of the new year.